Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What does the Dalai Lama really stand for? And what does his presence in the world mean for the people of Tibet and for the world at large? The 14th Dalai Lama became the full spiritual and political leader of his people in 1950, when he was just 15 years old. He has endured the occupation of Tibet by China and a violent but unsuccessful uprising that preceded his exile to India in 1959. Today, he has followers all over the world and the respect and affection of many of the most powerful leaders on the planet, although none has been able to persuade the Chinese government to return full sovereignty to Tibet or even regional autonomy under Chinese rule. So how has this 73-year-old leader changed with the times, and what does he expect to come of his people when he is no longer alive to lead them? Journalist and travel writer Pico Iyer has been a personal friend of the Dalai Lama since he was 17 years old. His book, just released in paperback, is called The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. Pico, welcome to Think.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
What sort of person is Tenzin Gyatso, the 14th Dalai Lama?
I think just the person that you've seen on TV, or if you've ever happened to listen to one of his lectures, extremely mischievous, a great sense of humor, affectionate, very alert, and I think his great gift is for instantly dissolving all divisions and just responding to you as a human being. So I think, for example, if you were to walk into your studio right now, and you might be a little daunted talking to the spiritual and temporal leader of the Tibetans, within a few seconds he'd find some way of removing all your fear, and you're thinking that you're just talking to your oldest friend in the world. He'd tug at your ponytail, or he'd point giggling at something on your desk. One way or another, I think he sort of manages to come off his throne and just appeal to us as somebody on our own level, dealing with the same questions and challenges we're all dealing with.
Is some of that, although clearly he has genuinely these parts of his personality, does some of that exist, though, deliberately to put people at their ease?
No, I think he's one of the most unselfconscious people I've ever met. So, no, I think because, as you said, he's been the leader of his people, actually his spiritual leader, since he was 4 years old. So he's been, as it were, a king for 69 years. Like any king, he's developed ways of understanding how to break the ice, and he realizes that as a president or any politician does, how to try to make contact. But I think what makes it real to people is that you can feel it's so genuine. And of course, when he was in Tibet, he was literally seen as an incarnation of a god far above the people. And to this day, Tibetans, when they're in his presence, can barely look in his face or barely talk to him. And I think he quickly realized that one of the virtues of exile was that being out in the larger world, he could suddenly function as a human being and not have to be up on a throne.
Does he, in fact, believe himself to be a living incarnation of Buddha?
He believes himself to be the Dalai Lama and the living incarnation of Avalokiteshvara, which is the Tibetan god of compassion. But I think the main thing he always stresses is his humanity. I was traveling across Japan with him not many months ago, and we were in a bullet train. And at one point, a journalist came in and asked the kind of question that I think any one of us might ask. And he said, "Your Holiness, if you had a magic wand, what would you do to resolve the situation in the Middle East?" And the Dalai Lama just looked at him in a very warm and direct way, as if, again, he was an old friend, and said, "Silly question. You know, in other words, if I had a magic wand, I'd find a cure for cancer, I'd bring peace to the world, I'd get impatience out of human hearts, I would resolve the situation in China and Tibet." But he said, "I'm just a human being. Just like you, I suffer the same frustrations." And I think that's part of the power of the Dalai Lama, and indeed of the Buddhism of which he's a part, because the Buddha himself always stressed, "I'm a human being, and what I do is really something that anyone else can do." And so I think the Dalai Lama always tries to demystify himself and tries to tell people, "I'm not superhuman. It's not as if I have all these gifts and talents that you can't have. If you find that there's some clarity or compassion in me, that's really just a reflection of what any one of you could access in yourselves, if you're so inclined."
What is a typical day for the Dalai Lama?
Very, very rigorous. I remember I once went in to see him, and I hadn't seen him for a few years, and I asked him, you know, how have things changed since I last saw you? And he said, oh, not so much. You know, I still have my spiritual practice, but I don't do very much of that. And I said, really? And he said, yeah, no, I wake up at 3:30 in the morning, and then I do 4 hours of meditation, and then I read philosophical texts, and then in the afternoon I take meetings with people. I take care essentially of my political business and the media and all the governmental responsibilities I have to do. And then at about 5:30, I go back to my room, and there's 2 more hours of meditation, and then I have a small snack, and then there's an hour of meditation, and then I sleep. So he said, well, I don't really have much spiritual practice, but when I counted it up, it was really about 8 hours a day of meditation. And when I follow him around, whenever he comes to Japan, I travel with him for the duration of his stay. And just watching him go through an average day makes me exhausted. It's really extraordinary how this 73-year-old man from, I'd say, 3:30 in the morning to 8:30 in the evening almost never stops.
It's fascinating to think that your first meeting with him was when you were 17. Can you talk about what you remember about that first encounter, and in particular, before you actually had the meeting, what you thought about?
What I should say by way of background is that as soon as the Dalai Lama arrived in exile 50 years ago this month, my father, who was a philosopher, went and back from England, where we were living, and went to meet him. So I was lucky, really, to inherit my acquaintance with the Dalai Lama through my father, who knew him since 1960. And then in 1974, I made my first real trip to India with my parents, and my father said, well, let's go and see the Dalai Lama. And, you know, I've got to confess, I was a typical 17-year-old boy. I wanted to meet Jerry Garcia or Leonard Cohen or some, you know, teenage icon. I didn't really want to meet a philosopher or colleague of my father's. But needless to say, like any 17-year-old, I didn't have much choice. So we took the overnight. So I didn't know much about him, really. And in those days, nobody in the world really knew about the Dalai Lama. He was like some semi-legendary figure out of the movie Lost Horizon. So we took the overnight train up from Delhi and then got into a car, and it's a four-hour taxi ride up from the last train station, winding around the zigzagging curves of the Himalayas. And this was midsummer, which is a very heavy monsoonal season. But there was no rain that day, and Dharamsala in 1974 was just a scatter of huts across the hillside. There was very little there. And as I remember it, we just really drove off to the last house on the road, a very modest yellow house, rang the doorbell, and went in to see the Dalai Lama. In those days, because he was little known by the world, it was very easy to go and spend a lot of time with him. And the single impression I have of it now, 35 years later, is that it was a day of very, very heavy fog. So as we sat in the room where he meets visitors, which has large picture windows looking out on the valley below, all I could see was mist. I couldn't see any other house. I could see no sign of the human world, of human habitation. And it really seemed to me as if these two philosophers, my father and the Dalai Lama, were on the top of a mountain talking about emptiness and reality and compassion and all these very lofty ideas. And it was a very otherworldly experience for me. And I mostly because I didn't know that, in truth, the Dalai Lama was already working day in, day out, negotiating with the Chinese government and really in the middle of realpolitik. But to me, he was this robed, very genial figure on the top of a mountain. And he still, at that point, had never even been to the U.S.
How cohesive is the Tibetan diaspora today as an ethnic and religious group?
Well, that's a very good question, and probably the one that most taunts the Dalai Lama. It's, I think, inevitably, it's somewhat divided. The Dalai Lama has done a remarkable job of recreating Tibet in exile, and in fact, making a new and improved Tibet, a kind of Tibet 2.1. And when he was forced out of Tibet itself and came into India, he said, well, this isn't a loss, this is an opportunity for us to do all kinds of things we couldn't do when we were living in seclusion. So he quickly set up temples and schools and new cultural centers around him and around the world. And in some ways, exiled Tibet as a cultural and philosophical organization or body of people is doing wonderfully. But as your question suggests, in terms of the pervading homesickness among the community and the people discussing what they should do about the fact that their country is being wiped off the map and they're just sitting outside it, unable to do anything. I think there's more and more division as the years go on, because inevitably most young Tibetans in India or in America have never seen Tibet. And they feel displaced and frustrated. And as the years go on and the Dalai Lama pursues his policy of nonviolence, but China doesn't give any ground at all, inevitably you hear more and more people saying, well, this has achieved nothing. Let's do something. Let's bomb a radio station. Let's make a 200-mile peace march. Let's do some protest, something or other, just to break this frustrating sense of just sitting by while we see and hear about our country being really bulldozed into non-existence. And the Dalai Lama, I see principally as an undeluded realist. He's been a leader of his people since he was 4 years old. He's never been in a position of sitting on a mountaintop being very romantic. So he knows exactly what's happening. And I remember the last time I talked to him about this, or recent time, about a few years ago, he said, well, when I die, probably 60 or 70% of Tibetans will try to follow my example of peace and tolerance. But that still leaves 30% who don't want that and who want a much more confrontational or even violent course. And he said, well, that's going to make for problems. And one of the problems is that Tibetan exiles are only allowed in exile to live in India because they're spiritual refugees. So if they started making political problems, it would almost be like me coming to stay at your house and enjoying your hospitality, and while I'm at your house, fomenting terrorism, which would not only harm everyone who's a victim of my terrorism, but would actually harm you, the generous host. So it's a serious problem, and there's very little that the Dalai Lama can do about it, especially because his policy of nonviolence hasn't so far reaped any obvious results.
Does he worry, Pico, as much about the acculturation of young Tibetans into wherever they're living as he worries about them sort of moving away from his ideals of nonviolence?
He clearly must worry that that most Tibetans in exile have so little first-hand contact with Tibet. But I think in some ways that's the least of his worries. And I think he realizes that's really just up to the individual. But to this day, most Tibetans are proud of their distinctive culture, their language and their philosophy. And as Tibetans come to Europe and Australia and America, they see that lots of us are interested in it. And so I think they realize that they're carrying a treasure and they don't want to lose that quickly. And so he always says that his first concern is with the 6 million Tibetans in Tibet who are denied basic human rights and just the freedom of speech and freedom of worship. And the Tibetans in exile have their own questions and challenges, but I think those are much less important for him.
What sort of contact is he able to have with those 6 million Tibetans who remain in Tibet?
That's another very good question. And I'm always amazed at how precisely he knows everything that's going on in Tibet. Through aides, I'm sure, through an unofficial grapevine, he can name specific monasteries across Tibet and specific monks who are doing good work and specific problems in his old hometown. So he's very, very plugged in. I think he knows more about what's happening in Tibet than any person outside Tibet does. And to this day, many Tibetans still risk their lives by taking the 30- or 40-day walk across the mountains, risking frostbite and death, to come and visit him in Dharamsala, in his exile home. So there's a steady stream of Tibetans coming out of Tibet, even to attend his teachings. So he does have contact with them. And what I've noticed, because I've been to Tibet 3 times, the first in 1985 and the most recently in this century, and I've found that precisely because of the oppression against the Tibetans and the attempt almost to wipe out their culture, their resistance is ever stronger, and their feeling of loyalty to the Dalai Lama and to their culture and to Buddhism is even stronger now, I think, than it was in 1984. So if you were to, 1985, if you were to visit Tibet tomorrow, I think if you met a Tibetan, the first way he would define himself is as a follower of the Dalai Lama. So in that sense, the connection is very strong still.
Journalist and travel writer Pico Iyer is my guest. He is also a personal friend of the Dalai Lama. His new book has been released in paperback. It's called The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. And if you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and travel writer Pico Iyer. His book has just been released in paperback. It's called The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. If you would like to join us, please send email to think@kera.org or call 1-800-933-5372. You know, Pico, when you talk about the fact that, most Tibetans today would consider themselves first and foremost followers of the Dalai Lama, it brings up this very sort of pressing issue, which is the fact that, at least in a physiological sense, the Dalai Lama is hardly immortal, and in fact, he's quite an elderly person.
Yes, and needless to say, he's been addressing that issue for almost 40 years now, assuming, you know, having to protect his people in the eventuality of his death. So, since 1969, when he was only 34 years old, he's consistently said that if there's another Dalai Lama, it'll only be one who's absolutely loyal to the Tibetan people, and in fact that there may not be any future Dalai Lama. If there is a new incarnation, almost certainly it will be born in exile. He will be born in exile, or actually she, because he's even said the next Dalai Lama could be a woman. But I think the main thing in his mind is clearly that as soon as he dies, the Chinese government will find some little boy and say, well, this is the new 15th Dalai Lama. And in some ways, hijack the whole incarnation and seem to take over Tibetan culture even more absolutely. So that's why, in this complicated chess game, he's preemptively said, that maybe a Dalai Lama doesn't serve a useful function now that we're in exile and we need a different kind of leadership. In fact, the last time I spent a lot of time with him in November, he said very outspokenly to large groups of Chinese people in Japan, the Dalai Lama institution served an ideal function for 350 years when we're in Tibet, but that time is gone. We need to open a new chapter. And my suspicion is that he will designate a successor from among the Tibetans around him in exile in India and tell his people, well, listen to this person as if he was speaking with my voice. This is the spirit that is going to lead you after I'm no longer around. And I think all Tibetans will listen to that. But of course, it is a difficult thing to have a leader in exile separated from 98% of his people.
He's also been open to the idea, I suppose, of moving more into democracy from theocracy and having an elected Dalai Lama.
Yes, or certainly having an elected leadership, and you're absolutely right. It's a strange situation, the Tibetan one, where you have the leader who's really eager to give the people as much power as possible, and the people who often say, well, no, we actually want autocracy. But exactly as you say, the first thing he did when he came into exile in 1959 was to start making up a democratic constitution for the first time in Tibetan history. And since then, he first set up a democratically elected parliament and then a democratically elected cabinet. And now he does have a democratically elected prime minister. And he always says that whatever happens to Tibet in the future, the Dalai Lama won't be the political leader, that now it's much healthier for them to have a democratic system, and that's really one of the great things that Tibet can learn from the rest of the world. He's always stressed that now that Tibet is mostly living outside Tibet, suddenly Tibet can offer its particular graces and strengths to all of us, and also that Tibet can learn from us. And I think democracy is one of the ideas he's most excited about. The only problem is that if you were to meet a Tibetan tomorrow and say, who do you want to be your leader? They'll reflexively, out of centuries of habit, always say the Dalai Lama. So it may take a little while for that transition to take place, but certainly he's very keen to bring as much power as possible to his people.
In addition to political occupation of Tibet, the Chinese government is working actively to populate Tibet with ethnic Han Chinese. Can you talk about how that's changing the region?
Yes. I mean, the capital of Tibet, Lhasa, is now principally a Chinese city. The majority of people living there are Han Chinese. The Tibetans are a minority in their own home. And this really comes home to you forcibly if you visit Lhasa. The first time I went to Tibet in 1985, Lhasa was exactly as you might imagine, really, from one's lost horizon images. It was just a cluster of whitewashed traditional Tibetan houses, a town of about 30,000 people, living under this beautiful Potala Palace on the mountain, the 1,000-roomed palace where the Dalai Lamas had always lived. And it conformed to all my notions of this unusual, distinctive settlement, 11,000 feet above the sea. If you go to Lhasa today, you'll essentially see Las Vegas. Huge broad boulevards, enormous blue glass shopping malls. Essentially, China has turned it into a very modern Chinese city, and for most parts of the city, you can't even see the Potala Palace, the great fortress where the Dalai Lamas used to live. Now, it's interesting, again, counterintuitively, the Dalai Lama often says, well, all the material and modern benefits that that China is bringing to Tibet are actually a good thing. He's the first person to say that Tibet was too isolated before and too far from the modern world, and that having modern facilities and having connections with the world is actually a good thing. And that's why he doesn't want Tibet to be separate from China. He applauds China's development and says that Tibetans are glad to be a part of it. But he says, even as we're getting development, that shouldn't mean that we lose our culture and our philosophy. And it's a good thing for us to get the modern world, but you shouldn't wipe out everything old in our culture in the process.
Do you sense respect among Han Chinese in Tibet who are not officials of the government for the people of Tibet and their culture and customs?
Well, I'd say that's a two-part question. It's a very difficult environment for any foreigner, for you and me, or for any Han Chinese, suddenly being living on 11,000 feet where the air is very thin and it's a very tough physical culture. That's difficult. And I'd say that the atmosphere is always uneasy in Tibet and in Lhasa, just because there are people from very, very different cultures. It's a little similar, perhaps, to Hawaii. And if people from Minnesota go to Hawaii, they have no ill will towards the Hawaiian people or culture, but it's just a shock for them, and it's a shock for the Hawaiians. But the other thing that's really interesting, and it's developing very quickly, is that among Han Chinese around the whole of China, there's more and more interest in Tibetan culture and actually in Tibetan Buddhism. So the last time I flew to Lhasa, I'd say 90% of the people on the plane were Han Chinese, and some of them were going the way we go to Alaska for economic opportunities, and some of them were going the way the rest of us go, just as tourists. But I think quite a few were actually going in order to seek out Tibetan Buddhist teachers and some of the great temples of Tibetan Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhist texts also. And if you think of it, you know, we're all aware of how Tibetan Buddhism has become quickly very popular in Europe and America and Australia and elsewhere, because people here feel that it answers some need that isn't being satisfied in the rest of their lives. And if we feel that, I think the Han Chinese would feel that even more, because for 60 years they've been officially denied any religion at all. And I think something in the human spirit cries out for just wisdom or guidance or solace. And so when a typical person in the People's Republic of China today has some deep question or problem in his heart and is looking around for spiritual guidance, he may well realize that actually within the boundaries of China now, in Tibet, lies one of the richest, deepest, and most ancient philosophical and spiritual traditions in the world. And understandably, as any of us might do, says, oh, well, maybe Tibetan Buddhism can answer this emptiness. And I think the Dalai Lama has great faith in the way it's a slow process, but the way each year more and more Chinese on an individual basis are making connections with Tibet and its culture. And he always says, in the last year especially, he said, well, my faith in the Chinese government is more and more thin, but my faith in the Chinese individuals and people is very, very strong.
And if I understand this correctly, Pico, there are really two schools of thought at work for people who would like to see the Dalai Lama restored to Tibet. One is that Tibet should be fully sovereign, and the other is that it should be given regional autonomy under Chinese national rule. Can you talk about why the Dalai Lama seems to now prefer the second option?
Yes. In fact, in 1987, he actually said, I'm not interested in independence. All I want is autonomy. And by that, he means that China could and should still control Tibet's foreign affairs and its defense affairs, but that the Tibetan people should have freedom over their culture and their heritage. So a kind of compromise. And I think it's partly realism, because he knows, what reason does China have to give Tibet absolute 100% independence? What reason would Washington tomorrow decide, oh, we're going to cut Hawaii free and make it its own sovereign nation. There's nothing, it doesn't stand to China's interest, having taken over Tibet, suddenly to surrender it. And so he says that's an impractical hope, and it's an unrealistic hope. Much better to do something more feasible. So that's part of his thinking, but the other, I think, comes from his Buddhist beliefs, which are all about interdependence and common ground and cooperation. And he always says, we were too cut off before, we were too sovereign and independent, and that China, that Tibet has a lot to gain from being part of China, as I was saying, being part of this dynamic modern nation that's growing so quickly and really bringing facilities and possibilities to its people that they never had before. And also, as I was saying, China has a lot to gain from Tibet in terms of its particular cultural strengths and richness. It's as if China can give Tibet material affluence and possibility, and Tibet can give China spiritual affluence and possibility. And so he says they shouldn't be separate. And also he knows that geographically, Tibet is right on China's doorstep, and it's like a mouse on the doorstep of a tiger. Even if the mouse is given freedom for a few years, the tiger's never going to forget about the possibility of snapping up that mouse again. So realistically, as two neighbors, it's much better that they work together. And I think autonomy in his vision means Tibet as part of China, but allowed to be still Tibet.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Pico Iyer is my guest. We're talking about his book, The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. Let's speak to Scott in Plano. Hello, Scott.
Oh, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
As a Buddhist in North America, and I'm a white guy, so I'm curious. You know, I understand the idea of autonomy. I would like to know your speaker's thoughts on why international governments, particularly the U.S., hasn't done more for Tibet to support at least autonomy, because it seems like we do more for even Darfur than we've done for Tibet. And these people are more in line with our values than some of the countries that we send aid to. And I was just curious, as one who's been inundated with the situation for many years, what his thoughts were on that.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Scott, that's a terrific question. And I remember a few years ago, I was talking to the Dalai Lama, and I said, what's the single most difficult aspect of your very complicated life? And instantly, he said, meeting with politicians. Because, he said, realistically speaking, he knows there's very little that the American government or the other governments of the world can do. And yet, at the same time, he said he can't not meet with them. He has to keep the door open, so he has to keep coming to Washington and Brussels and London and elsewhere. But I think he just acknowledges that with China as the largest country and the largest market in the world, our government and most governments in the world, all their sympathies are with the Dalai Lama. Most leaders are very keen to talk to him and to learn from him and to bask in the glow of his charisma and warmth. But on a practical level, very few of them are ready to antagonize the largest and perhaps most formidable nation on earth. And so that's been a great problem facing him. And I think one interesting answer he's come up with to this problem is realizing that these days in the global world and in the mediated world, the media-filled world, actually individuals can do a lot of things that governments can't. And I think one reason why he's allowed Richard Gere and various rock groups and lots of NGOs and all kinds of small bodies around the world to rally themselves behind Tibet is he realizes that, say, a Richard Gere or Bono or many other figures can actually speak to the global constituency more than our government. Many, many years ago, Gore Vidal said, the center of the world now is not Washington, it's Hollywood. And I think, especially as we enter this global village, there is a little bit of truth to it. Now, it's certainly true that all the Tibet's well-wishers haven't managed to change Chinese policy so far, but they have managed to bring Tibet to the attention of the world. And you're right that we're hearing a lot about Darfur at the moment. But in some ways, there are many other oppressed minority areas in China, including Chinese Turkestan and Mongolia, and in some ways we hear even less about them than Tibet. So I think some of this other oppressed minority areas were a little envious of Tibet, because at least Tibet does have this charismatic, universally respected leader and this wonderful culture that people are keen to make contact with. So when people ask the Dalai Lama, are you disappointed that Washington hasn't done more, he said, well, he always says, well, in an ideal world, yes, I wish they could do more, but I know this isn't an ideal world, and I'm appreciative of all that they have done.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak next with Thomas in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Yes, I was wondering if the Dalai Lama has said anything about the Israel-Palestine issue. Some of these facts sound remarkably similar, and it always sort of it seems odd to me that you see so many Free Tibet stickers when we have so little to do with it, or we get so little information on Palestine.
Yes, he's been many times to the region, and he's one thing that people don't understand about the Dalai Lama is that he's a very keen and acute student, since he was a little boy, of world affairs. So usually when I go into his room, there's always a newspaper. That's what he's in the middle of doing. And he knows more about what's going on in the world at any given moment than I and most of my journalist friends do. So he's thought a lot about that. In fact, at certain times over the years, he's had Jewish leaders come and visit him and talk about how to keep a culture alive when you don't have a territory of your own. And he's looked to the Jewish precedent for how, for hundreds and hundreds of years, Judaism remained strong and cohesive, even though it didn't have a geographic center. And he's tried to see what Tibetans can learn from that. And at the same time, as maybe your question is suggesting, he's thought a lot about the Palestinian issue and those landless people and what his people can learn from them. And he's also looked at, for example, the Native American populations here and the Aborigines in Australia and other groups that have been displaced. So he's thought long and hard about the pros and cons of various ways of operating. I think in some ways he says that the Palestinians have one advantage over the Tibetans, which is that they're at the center of a part of the world that is America's concern, and it is always in the news. And I think we hear more about what's going on in the Middle East than we hear about Tibet. And especially in the last year, China has imposed a kind of media blackout on Tibet, so we don't hear anything about it. But to answer your question, yes, he spent a lot of time thinking about the Middle East and actually visiting it, going to Jordan and going to Jerusalem and looking at it as is his way from all angles.
Pico Iyer is my guest. We're talking about his latest book, recently released in paperback. It's called The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. You can join us after the break by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. You can get ahead in today's tough economy with hundreds of courses beginning this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and travel writer Pico Iyer. He is a personal friend of the Dalai Lama, and his book has just been released in paperback. It's called The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org or by calling 1-800-933-5372. So obviously, Pico, the Dalai Lama has cultivated a lot of healthy relationships with world leaders, and you mentioned earlier his willingness to have conversations with celebrities who might bring attention to the plight of the Tibetans. I wonder if you can talk for a minute about the difference between his discourse when he is talking to people who might be from the West or other cultures, leaders who would be sympathetic, as opposed to speaking specifically to other Tibetans and other Buddhists.
Well, I think the sovereign quality of the Dalai Lama is that he's the most solid, consistent person I've ever met, and that from an early age he went through this 20-year training in Buddhism, and that will always remain the core of his being and his thinking. But at the same time, he's a very curious man, and he's a very empirical, practical man. And so I think what I've seen is that the core of his thinking remains absolutely the same, but he finds new and different ways of applying it in different contexts. So deep down, if you look at what he's saying to President Obama or President Bush or to his Tibetan people, it's exactly the same. But what he's a master at is finding different ways of articulating it in different examples. And he knows that the Tibetan people regard him as a god. He speaks in a more formal way, of course, in very, very beautiful classic Tibetan. He inhabits his authority a lot more with them because he realizes that they want somebody who will speak to them as their ancestral leader. When he's in Washington, he speaks just as a human being, and he almost leaves behind his ceremonial and his official aspect. And it's interesting because the Buddha himself always stressed what he called skillful means, which means that if you're talking to a philosopher, you talk in one way. If you're talking to a four-year-old girl, you talk in another. If you're talking to your grandmother, you talk in another. And it doesn't mean that you're inconsistent. You're probably saying the same thing in each of those contexts, but you're finding the best and the most accessible and useful way of making of expressing it according to the situation. And I think the Dalai Lama is a master of that, and I think that's partly why and how he's become so popular. It's a gift that most philosophical or spiritual leaders don't have. So that when he's talking to, let's say, 20,000 people in Dallas, he'll take this very complicated, sophisticated, high-flown philosophy of Tibetan Buddhism and distill it into very simple, concrete, everyday things about how to get on better with your boss or your neighbor or your wife. And then when he turns around and goes and talks to Tibetan monks again, he speaks as essentially a PhD in philosophy, whose talk is so complex and rarefied that I think most of us wouldn't be able to follow. But he's very good after 69 years as leader of the Tibetans in knowing how to switch at the speed of light. So I'll sometimes see him, let's say, visiting Harvard and talking to philosophers there and at a very, very high level. And he walks out of the auditorium and a six-year-old girl comes up to him and shakes his hand, and instantly he knows how to do and say the right thing to her.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Arun in Louisville. Hi, Arun.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The speaker alluded to the fact that Dalai Lama is instilling democracy in Tibet. I would like to know from him how much of that is the influence of Indian democracy on him. He has been living in India since the 50s, and India is a very thriving democracy. So I'd like to hear from him how much of that has been a great influence. Has it been a great influence at all, or has he learned mainly only from the Western democracy?
Arun, I think we have the nature of your question. You're breaking up there, but Pika, were you able to get enough of that to
I was. And you know, the first thing that the Dalai Lama said when he set foot in India, having fled at Lhasa in 1959, he turned around to his little brother and he said, "Now we are free," which is an amazing thing to say when you've just lost your country and the people you were born to lead and the life that you knew. But I think what he was saying was, now we are free suddenly to learn from the rest of the world and to change things in Tibet. So your question is a perfect one, and he always stresses that he's learned a huge amount from India, and as you say, from living in the biggest and perhaps the most vibrant democracy in the world. And I think as soon as he set foot in India, he realized, well, now I can learn all the things that India has to offer our Tibetan culture that we haven't had access to before. And then when he began traveling around the world and starting coming to this country, he thought, well, now I can learn from the wonderful, unique democracy of America, too. But one thing he always stresses is that he's a Buddhist first and foremost, and the Buddhism and Buddha arose out of India. And so he always refers to Tibet as almost the little brother or the student of India. And he says that there's a certain poetic symmetry and beauty in the fact that Tibetans now, and he has come back to India, which is really the birthplace of their philosophy, and in the process has also been able to bring Buddhism back to India, where it you know, hasn't been so popular over the years. But he always stresses how much he has to owe to India. And also, India, a big, complicated country with its own problems, has been so generous in taking in 100,000 Tibetans and giving them a home for 50 years. And he never misses an opportunity to express his gratitude to India for taking his people in and for teaching them, as you say, about democracy and about tolerance and pluralism and many of the things that India has to offer.
How do the people of India who are not Buddhist tend to feel about their 100,000 Tibetan guests?
I think that's worked out very well. 100,000, after all, is not a huge amount in the context of 1.2 billion, which is the population of
sure.
India. And I think India has actually gained from the Tibetan presence. I noticed, let's say 20 years ago, if you were to visit India from America and you go into a bookshop, you'd see that most of the ways in which India presented itself to the world was the Taj Mahal, certain palaces, Indian philosophy. If you go into that same bookshop today, I think maybe 30-40% of the books you'll see on offer representing the wonders of India are about the Dalai Lama and Tibetan Buddhism. And so Tibetan Buddhism has now become one of the great assets and attractions of India. And young Indians, I think, who are ever more like young Americans in their habits and interests, are actually beginning to turn to Buddhism, which began in India but hasn't been very, very well known there for a long, long time. So I think the Tibetans have integrated very well, really, in India.
There's an interesting dichotomy at play because clearly the Dalai Lama's entire life is shaped by his very deep faith, and yet he counsels his own people not to be sort of religious zealots. Can you talk about that?
Yes. I mean, I think his first and fundamental principle is reason. And even the Buddha was not outlining a faith, let alone a dogma or a religion, but just a training of mind. And I think often Dalai Lama and other Buddhists will describe Buddhism not as a religion, but as a science of mind. And it's almost the way that you and I can go to the gym every day, pick up weights, walk on the treadmill, make ourselves healthier and stronger. And whether we're agnostics or Muslims or Christians or Hindus, any one of us can do that. And I think he often really sees Tibetan Buddhism as like a gymnasium of the mind, a training of the mind. And he always stresses that anyone, whether you're an agnostic or Han Chinese or somebody with no interest in Buddhism, you too can make your mind healthier and stronger just if you do certain practices. And in that sense, the Tibetan Buddhists are a little like sort of personal trainers of the mind rather than of the body, who are offering things that don't have anything to do with their particular religion or ideology or dogma, but that anyone can gain from. And I think that's why this Dalai Lama, for example, delivered a series of talks on the Gospels to a group of Christians in Britain. He sometimes called himself a defender of Islam. And his greatest passion of all as a human being is science. And I think many of the scientists he works with probably have no interest in religion. And he says, that's fine. Really what I'm interested in is the laws of the world, like the laws of nature and the laws of gravity, and finding out what they are and then finding out what we can do with them. So he's done, again, a great job of taking Tibetan Buddhism and really just making it a universal human thing.
Has it worked to his detriment, Pico, that he has been so often so trusting of the good intentions of other people?
Well, I think it's better than the alternative, that to be distrusting is almost to give up on life. And it's like the debate all of us have between being too hopeful or too resigned. Each has its problems, but in the end, it's better to be too hopeful if you really want to make a better life than to sort of give up on the prospect before you've begun. I think the single example that he often mentions about being too trusting is that when he was 19, he went to Beijing for a year at the invitation of Chairman Mao, and they formed quite a strong friendship, and the Dalai Lama, again, was very impressed by certain of the things having to do with equality and opportunity that he saw in Marx or communist China. And Mao Zedong treated him, he often says, as a father. So they both got on quite well, and then just at the end, as the Dalai Lama was about to return to Tibet, Mao Zedong turned to him and said, of course, you know that religion is poison. You know that Buddhism is a blight on the earth. And suddenly, the Dalai Lama chill went through him, and he suddenly realized, well, this man who's been so interesting and hospitable and impressive in certain ways, ultimately, he's wants to wipe out my people and my religion. And he realized that perhaps he'd been a little too trusting of Mao Zedong. But to this day, 50 years later, I remember I was traveling on a train with him, and I said something unfavorable about Mao Zedong. And he said, criticize the action, but not the person. So to this day, he's amazingly forgiving, even towards Mao Zedong, who initiated the Chinese takeover of Tibet.
And this is maybe a small example and a small story, but he's also very detail-oriented. There's one story you tell about having interviewed him, and as you both got up to leave the room, he stopped for a moment and went back in and turned off the light behind him.
Yes. And again, I think mostly just very practical and concrete. And I think one of the great things I've got from him is not just that he's offering lofty ideas about the golden rule and kindness and an understanding, though he is doing all that, but he always finds an everyday application for that. And that was, in fact, the day after he'd won the Nobel Prize, and he happened to be in California, and I went to visit him, and we had an interesting discussion. In fact, the first thing he did was to turn to me and say, well, I've won all this money, what should I do with it? Which is an interesting thing. I think what hits you often when you meet the Dalai Lama is he's much more interested in listening than to talking. And so when you go to see him, he doesn't want to tell you about how the world works. He wants to find out from you about your particular expertise, and he's much keener to be a student, I think, than a teacher. So that impressed me, too, that this man has just won the Nobel Prize for Peace, and he's turning to a 30-year-old journalist and asking him genuinely how he should use the money. And then the other thing that impressed me was that as soon as we went into the room, he spent to talk. The day after he was awarded the Nobel Prize, he spent the first 3 or 4 minutes trying to find a chair in which I would be comfortable, as if I were the Nobel laureate, and he was just some intrusive journalist. And then, as you say, when we finished the conversation, we walked out of the room and suddenly said, oh, wait a minute. And he went back and he turned off the light. And he said, well, that's such a tiny thing. But it's something that every human being across the world can do 20, 30 times a day, whether they're Han Chinese or Buddhists or Christians or whoever they are, any one of us can do it. And if all of us just do this small act a few times a day, if we think about it more and are more attentive, that can actually help our entire global household. It will help the environment. So it's a tiny thing, but ultimately, if more and more of us remember to do it, it can have a vast effect. And these days, we hear more and more about environmental consciousness. But when he said that in 1989, it wasn't something that I'd heard often. And here I am 20 years later, and I still remember that single detail because it's something I can do, and in fact do, thanks to him, many times a day.
Would he caution all of us who admire him, perhaps from quite a far distance, against an overly romanticized picture of who he is as a human being and as a leader?
Absolutely. The last lecture I saw, before any public address, he begins and he says, I'm just a human being. And if you come looking for magic or miracles or special wisdom, sorry, you've come to the wrong place. And, you know, his health hasn't been very good these days. Recent years, and he'll often cough at that point. And he said, well, if I were a magic person, I'd get rid of this cough or this sore throat I have, but I'm not. And then often the first question, when he opens it up to questions, will be, well, you said you're a human being, but sorry, we think of you as a god, and there's nothing he can do about that. But he's always trying to stress that. And as I say, he's doing that not just to remind us that he's one of us, but also to remind us that we have the same potential as him. And if we think of him as some superhuman being, we're in a sense doing ourselves an injustice. And so I think he's always saying, I'm the same as you, and therefore you can do some of the things. If you see something to admire in me or something you really respect, well, bring it into your own life, and I'm sure you can do that also.
Pico Iyer's book has just been released in paperback. It's called The Open Road, The Global Journey of the 14th Dalai Lama. Pico, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
Thank you, and thank you for having an hour-long program. It's a great luxury.
It is. My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.